This episode of Forensic Forecast is brought to you by Digital Forensics Magazine at www.digitalforensicsmagazine.com and by contributions via listeners. Thank you all very much. Welcome to Forensic Forecast. And today we're joined by Eric Huber. How are you doing, Eric?
Very good. Thank you for having me on again.
Always a pleasure. Eric's the author of A Fistful of Dongles, and from the looks of things, that thing's getting quite a few nominations in the Forensic Forecast Awards.
Oh, that's good. So the inside the core people will sabotage me again. Even though they don't do a blog, but I know they're behind it.
Don't give me ideas. I'll probably try and do one now.
Just to spite me, exactly. Are we getting any nominations for Forensic Forecast?
Are they going
to beat us again? Okay, that's good.
And also joining us, Doug. How you doing?
I'm doing well.
And Doug's joining us for the second time. Well, it would have been the third time if last week had gone a little bit better, I suppose.
Two and a half.
Yeah, well, if things were going properly last time, then, you know, it would have been three by now. But, oh well, the computer seems to be fine. So we'll go on. Also joining us this week for the first time ever is Joseph. How are you doing, Joe?
Hi, I'm fine. Thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, cool. All right. Well, just to start with, we just want to ask Eric about something. Apparently he's going to be teaching some SANS courses soon.
Yes, I have to plug a class. Usually I'm just here plugging the blog, but this time I'm actually plugging a class. SANS New Jersey 2011, which is actually me. It's Community SANS. It's the event will be in Morristown, New Jersey, which is it's actually in the New York metro area. It doesn't take that long to get from the city to Morristown and vice versa. I know a lot of us who work in forensics in the New York metro area. I know a lot of us live in New Jersey, so we thought, well, let's just do it here. So that is from May 9th through Saturday, May 14th, and that's Forensics 408, which has been renamed. It used to be called Computer Forensics Fundamentals, and that didn't work very well. So Rob and company renamed both classes. So this is now Computer Forensic Investigation Windows in Depth. So it's going to be a lot of fun, and it's the six-day class. It used to be a five-day class. Now we're at the six-day version, and that six-day adds a lot of really good log content. So you can go to the website, the SANS website, and then I'm going to have a blog post up, hopefully in the next couple of days, actually on A Fistful of Dongles blog that points to the event.
Very cool.
Yeah, and Eric, just remind me. I'll post that through the because I help manage the New York ForSec meetup community group, and I'll make sure I'll get it out to our members too. Being that we're so close, that
yeah, that's great. Yeah, the whole idea SANS. You know, they have these great major events all over the place, but they tend not to have them in New York along with everyone else because it's so expensive to hold major conventions there. So they do a lot of – it's kind of a good news, bad news situation. The bad news is they don't do major events in the city, but the good news is you have a lot of community SANS events that they do, including with some of the top instructors, because you have some of the top instructors actually live here, Lenny Zeltzer and Ed Skotis, for example, are in the neighborhood. So, you know, you can get a lot of good community SANS content.
Fantastic. And what's the do you know what the progress is with the CFCE now? Because that's related to the 408 class, isn't it? What am I talking about? I'm jumping.
Yeah, well, we can talk about both. Yeah, right. The GCFE, right.
That's the one I meant to say, yeah, obviously. Yeah,
absolutely. So
it's going well already.
Yeah, no, we're right on track. The GCFA used to be SANS primary digital forensic certification, and that was that mirrored the content for the 508 class. So now within, I think it's October of last year, the GCFE, GX Certified Forensic Examiner, went live, and that is for the content of 408. So, and we're starting to get people, starting to see actually a lot more people who have taken it now, so it's starting to take off. So yeah, that's also part of the class. you can, I think it's for $499, I think is extra to the, for the class, and you get the GCFE attempt. So yeah, that's good. It's online. I'm actually going to be taking it soon because they want to have the instructors who actually teach the class, the community SANS instructor. So I'm going to take that. And I know there's several other people studying for the class. I think Joe Garcia is going to, he's added it to his to-do list also, along with all the other SANS stuff he's doing.
He seems as if he does every single class which he can.
He does. He does all the SANS class. He's got a. He seems like they got a really good budget, so he's.
Yeah, my New York City tax dollars at work. It's awesome.
from your wallet into Joe's pocket.
Yeah,
that's great. So yeah, wicked. All right, cool. Well, I've got a couple of stories to get through today. First thing I want to talk about. Is this HB Gary story? I know everyone's probably already heard about this by now, but the general gist of it is that HB Gary is there's HB Gary and HB Gary Federal. HB Gary Federal subcontracts to the government, I believe, hence the name. And one of the people who working for HB Gary Federal, quote unquote, infiltrated the group of hackers known as Anonymous, and allegedly got hold of contact details and you know, complicated structure of this organization. And Anonymous said, "Well, no, you haven't. If you release these names, you're going to get a lot of innocent people in a lot of trouble." And then they started to attack HB Gary and HB Gary Federal. Yeah, basically crippling them temporarily while they sorted stuff out. Now, the story's developed over the last few weeks, and it's been, well, shall we say, interesting, to say the least.
It's a bit of a mess.
it's a huge mess. You know, I personally don't like to kick a company when they're down. And so, HB Gary has suffered a huge, I mean, just in terms of PR capital, I mean, they've suffered a huge loss in the last month, you know, and plus operating in this professional space, you know, you kind of want to be careful about what you say because it's a very small professional world. But it is, you know, it's interesting when my non-technology oriented mother knows the name HB Gary now. I mean, it's appeared on everything from, I think even Stephen Colbert ran it on the Colbert Report, talking about Anonymous and WikiLeaks and, HB Gary. And it was interesting to see how well they distilled basically the gist of the whole thing down into a 3-minute segment, with a heck of a lot of comedy. And you're right, there is a distinction between the HB Gary company, which does the forensic software, the tools, you know, the blogs, and HB Gary Federal, which is really a professional services company to the federal government. But, you know, you got to wonder how much of an impact this is going to have on their business. You know, because when you're touting yourself as security experts and you are, you know, marketing yourself in a very, very competitive space like the federal, federal services divisions, you know, it looks really bad when something like this happens, you know, and the sad part is it's been played out so publicly what's happened. You know, I mean, we've gotten insight into the breach that, you know, when most big companies are hit, we never get the kind of inside information that we've gotten on this breach. So from a responder perspective, there's a huge amount of what I consider useful information for my professional life about, you know, just the analysis of a real world attack. You know, I think that's been one of the hallmarks of this thing is that they have been absolutely so open.
Yeah, no, there's so many different layers and levels to it. You know, there's the, you know, when you're kind of from the inside looking out, you know, when you're in the kind of community, you're like, wow, you know, this one can happen to everybody, and you do get to see the kind of you know, everybody but the shoemaker's kids, you know, to see that, well, you know, they're just as vulnerable as everybody else. So there's just that kind of aspect of it. But I also look at it too from the set fact that I, you know, professionally, I know there's a lot of good people. You know, I've run maybe one or two people from HB Gary and seem like really nice people that, you know, now are having to deal with professional issues that were outside of their control for, and they were probably doing a very good job. And they're now there's just that kind of that top down, you know, from management, they make a really kind of a gaffe that everybody else has to pay for. And yeah, it's really unfortunate, you know, and I think it reflects poorly within the security and forensic and investigation industry. I mean, listen, we all kind of get into areas where, you know, we see a lot of private things and we deal with a lot of, you know, what can be kind of either clandestine or gray areas where people have a lot of trust in what we're doing is in good faith. And when you see things like this do get kind of exposed, it's like, well, you know, now it reflects poorly on everybody because the trust issue is kind of weakened. And that's what I find professionally very hard to deal with. That's like, now people kind of look at us saying, well, how do we know that you're not out to do something nefarious? And it's like, well, you have to kind of always try to convince them that you're on the good side. And not that it's necessarily good or bad sides, but that there's good intentions and good faith in technology and a lot of areas that your clients or the public might not even understand really at the granular level of what we're doing. And it makes it very hard to try to convince people that it's okay what we're doing.
Yeah. I think a lot of the threats and stuff which have come through as well, they're more than just made at a professional level, like saying, right, we're going to, you know, damage your company or anything else. But apparently there's been a lot of personal type threats as well coming through, which is quite scary, I imagine. Especially, you know, if you're, like you say, if you're somebody who just sits down and does your job every day, and then all of a sudden you're getting threats because there's somebody in you know, a company which is associated to yours has done something wrong, then, or not necessarily something wrong, but just brought this upon you, it's a bit scary.
Yeah, well, I worked for Enron, I worked for an Enron subsidiary about the time they went through their bankruptcy. And I have to tell you that professionally, that was a huge blow to my career. I think it took about almost 3 years before my career really recovered.
Wow.
Because, you know, being a mid-level professional in a corporation with you know, a black mark against their name. You know, I wasn't shredding documents. I wasn't destroying evidence. I wasn't trading or, you know, doing anything wrong. I was an information security professional, an incident responder doing my job day to day. But, you know, I would go into job interviews after I was laid off with everyone else, and people would look at my resume and said, oh, you worked at Enron. And, you know, just the tone and the look, I knew that interview was a wash at that point. You know, and I realized that you know, that 16-month time frame on my resume was really it was a black mark against me at that point. And so, yeah, I totally feel bad for anyone who works there who has to deal with that kind of stuff, because, you know, obviously a lot of people weren't involved in the day-to-day operations of the company, and they still have to deal with the ramifications.
It's certainly a branding nightmare. I mean, it's just for the company and for the folks who work for that. And yeah, my take on the HB Gary thing is, you know, I don't really want to throw rocks because it could have been me. But yeah, it's you know, I go back to, like, I remember one of the famous breaches in our community was the guidance software breach. I remember that, and that had, you know, that hit the media, but it wasn't as bad as this, because, you know, I don't even remember who did the breach, and I'm not sure I ever found that out. Whereas this, HB Gary had the misfortune of being breached by an organization that has media attention and has the ability to get its message out and people pick it up. So if this same breach had happened with, you know, some Russian cyber criminal gang, for example, knocked them over because they wanted to grab the intellectual property, you know, would it have been disclosed? Who knows? Would there have been the same response? Probably not.
No.
It may not have helped, but, you know, when you get knocked over by, you know, a group like Anonymous, that, you know, part of it, what they do is you know, their information warfare, and then part of what they do is media communications, and they're good at it. Yeah. So yeah, it's a terrible day to have your company knocked over like that. And I'm just real curious to see what will happen. One of the things that came out, I do sort of want to talk about one of the controversies, quote unquote, was, I don't understand this, but some people were, I don't know if the offended is the right word or surprised that they were working on malware for a defense contractor. And there was, and I know some people were, treated that as if it were some sort of surprise or some sort of scandal. But if you should look at a lot of what's going on today in the space of information warfare as actual cyber warfare, and as Rob Lee has taught us, APT is a who, not a what. It makes sense that the U.S. government and defense contractors are going to be developing weapon systems to be used for the government. So H.B. Gary or some sort of outside firm helping the U.S. government develop weapon systems in cyberspace isn't any different than them doing that in the physical world. The Defense Department doesn't make tanks. They have people do that for them. So that's one of the things that came out, and I'm not sure if that was a revelation to some, but that was one of the little mini scandals that didn't make any sense to me.
Well, yeah, and they're certainly not the only vendor who's done that type of work. But, getting back to APT, when you hear that, Stuxnet modifies the rotation cycle of, centrifuges processing nuclear waste, for me, I think that's a really elegant solution to deal with a real world problem without dropping bombs and killing people, So on one hand, I think, I look at Stuxnet and I think, wow, that's actually very interesting to me. And I don't want to say I like it, but I think it's better than, outright kinetic weapons damage. If you can handle what you perceive to be a problem in such an elegant way, without the loss of actual real life.
Yeah, if you could somehow figure that out, get that result. I mean, the Iranian nuclear issue. If you could somehow actually eliminate that through, and you can't eliminate that. I'm sure this was just my suspicion. I'm sorry. I'm keep thinking it's like, I know there's a lot of debate about that. Is it a nation state actor? It's like I just keep thinking it's got to be a nation state actor. If you could ever eliminate a threat like that through cyber weapons. And I keep doing it. I hate using the word cyber as much as everyone else, but now I find myself doing it. So now I understand why people do it. But anyway, if you can do that through those sort of for weapon systems, it'd be interesting if someone could ever pull that off. Could you destroy a major weapon system through that way? And if you could, it certainly opens up a possibility of, oh, great, now they're going to come after our power system, or there's a lot of horrifying things that can happen with it. But on the same time, it's like, boy, if that keeps you out of a kinetic situation where a lot of people get killed, that would be it's interesting. I will be very interested to see in my lifetime how this develops and how it changes the nature of warfare.
Yeah, it's definitely – I mean the numbers are somewhere like – when I first started looking at the field of forensics, there was the side of, you can get information security for litigation support, where I'm kind of more now, and it's – a $2 billion industry, but what's the next one on the horizon? As soon as, the cyber warfare term got coined, was a $12 to $14 billion projected industry for cyber warfare, cyber defense, however you want to coin it. And it's a lot of money to be pushed out from the from the government side into the contractors to, they're going to develop something with that much money. And if it's not baking hard goods and it's, you're fueling, brain power instead, that's a lot of money you can get people to do things, in pretty interesting ways.
Absolutely. I've got a question then. Is it, and you guys think that this is, it's quite close to home. So let me try and think of where I'm going to phrase this. Do you think this is one of the repercussions which we could see happening in the future with people like us who are involved in perhaps the legal side of digital forensics? Are we going to start seeing more of this kind of thing happening? If we say, right, well, we're involved in a big case where such and such against such, and these are both like really large companies, how easy is it going to be for somebody to go along and say, right, well, we're going to hire someone, they're going to come in, they're going to attack your infrastructure, and we're going to make, you're going to wipe out your credibility by making you look stupid that way?
I think I would say I see that happening now. I mean, there's, you know, especially it's information warfare one way or the other. I can see it in litigation cases that I've been involved with where, you know, somebody gets aggressive to go into basically image an entire environment beyond the scope of what might be pertinent to the legal matter at hand. But now you're gaining insight into how your competitor works, how they're thinking, and without certain protection, if you know, one side is not savvy enough in using forensics and electronic discovery and really kind of knowing how to protect their client from getting somebody in there that's going to be overreaching, it can certainly be a way that one side can be, you know, really aggressive and then air things out about somebody. And I've certainly seen it happen.
Yeah, it's a good illustration why not only do you need cutting edge on the technical side, and not only do you need people like Doug, but you need attorneys who are skilled in this. And when I first started many, many years ago, I was working in, was actually started doing in the e-discovery space also. You would find a lot of attorneys, very smart attorneys, who just didn't know anything of electronic discovery. And your job as a consultant, of course, was to get them up to speed and give them the information they need. But that's not as good as having attorneys who know this firsthand. And now we're starting to see a lot of very sharp attorneys who know this firsthand, who, you know, understand this. You know, they don't necessarily need the education that they did before. And that's good for us because it makes our lives easier. But it also, I think it adds a certain degree of complexity, because if you have, you know, two highly skilled attorneys battling away on a piece of litigation, it can get very interesting very quick. And even the judges know more. And Doug, I'm sure you've probably seen this, but you know, it used to be the triers of fact. You know, again, you know, generally very smart people didn't know as much now. And now they know quite a bit. So you see a lot of decisions and opinion pieces coming out from, you know, various magistrates in the federal government. So it's an interesting space to work in.
Does this scare anybody? I always thought that working in forensics would be, like, dicey at times. Like, I thought, if you know, if I had prepared a forensic report which sent somebody to prison for something or other, what's stopping them from coming back and taking retribution on me, for one? And then, you know, stuff like what's happening with Anonymous, where they could essentially crush the company that you work for very, very quickly. Does it not scare anyone, these thoughts, or am I just really, really paranoid?
We think about it in the office. We've, you know, on my side, we've thought about, I mean, some of where I'm doing litigation support, the other investigators that deal a lot with, you know, maybe tracking, you know, we do a lot of stuff with brand protection, and you'll get overseas outfits that are using various electronic means. If we're tracking down IP addresses and you're trying to shut down maybe somebody that's doing some kind of you know, phishing scam under a brand name, you know, you always wonder. It's like, well, you know, if they found out, you know, that we were the ones to do it, is it ever going to come back? You always kind of worry with what you do with people, or, you know, when you kind of expose them or even threaten to, not even threaten, but, you know, have that risk of exposing them. What's really stopping them? What's your names on the, you know, the paper that you're reporting on?
It's job security.
Yeah.
I mean, it is. It really is. Because I think we've talked about this before. In digital forensics, we tend to be prone to catastrophic thinking. You know, I remember BitLocker was the end of digital forensics. Large hard drives was the end of digital forensics.
The cloud ended it, too.
The cloud was the end. thin clients. It's like, look, guys, just calm down. There's always going to be some bit of technology that needs to be parsed for some legal purpose. I have no idea 20 years from now, what it's going to look like. But there will always be some what we do is the convergence of law and technology. So that's not going away. The thing, the technology changes so much, especially, right now mobile devices are the big thing, but who knows what's going to be, 20 years from now.
Well, I think the thing is too, is that, going back to the source topic here is that, it comes down to us as people, practitioners in the field. There's a level of peer review is the only way to really kind of keep a lot of us in check, because most of the people have no clue what we do, how we do it. And, we just have to be, and are continuing to have to be more wary that there are privacy issues in what we're doing, and know the boundaries and not go too far. And I think that was kind of really at the root of what the HB Gary thing was, potentially there, that looks like people might have just gone a little too far with it. And we just have to know the boundaries of what's kind of socially acceptable or acceptable in business.
Yeah. I think what scares me is does this incident sort of set the tone going forward for future intrusions? Now it's interesting because Anonymous has such a great PR machine inside of it, and they have a lot of exposure. But are we going to see this kind of these types of information disclosures with companies going forward? Because usually with what we deal with, a lot of the times, we find these types of intrusions, but we find them, and they're still under the radar. No one's gone out saying, "Ha ha, we owned your company."
Yeah,
The Chinese aren't doing that,
right?
Haha, we owned Google.
There you go. As a corporate incident responder, my worry is this kind of character. I mean, this is the HB Gary thing is really nothing more than digital character assassination. When you think about it, and so is this the kind of thing that I'm going to have to deal with going forward? Am I going to see more of this?
I don't think so. At least I hope not. I think this is – I wouldn't call it a completely isolated case. But if you look at what was Anonymous's purpose, well, their purpose was to infiltrate and then publicly talk about what they found. Their purpose wasn't to – most intrusions, the purpose is, all right, I want to knock over your machines because I want to use your machines as a platform for something else, or I want to knock over your machines because I want to steal your intellectual property or to steal your credit cards. In those circumstances, it doesn't make sense for the attacker to publicize it. This, if you look at it, and if I got this wrong, the entire purpose of the breach was for public disclosure reasons. There's no real profit motive in that. A lot of what we see with cyber criminals either, you have these breaches for intelligence reasons because you have nation states, they have the guys doing the breaching. They have, specific, they've got their list of things that their intelligence or their intelligence commanders above them have said, look, we need to go out. We need to grab this information. And then you've got the profit motive. It's like, okay, I'm knocking over this organization because I need credit card numbers. So I don't think this is going to be a major new subcategory of breaches, but it is going to be something. Anonymous, they're not the only people who have noticed this, so I'm sure there's other groups now of looking at this going, hey, this is a way you can do some serious damage to a company. So I'll be curious to see how this turns out, and if there's any people who take what's done and do it in the future.
Right. Well, I mean, if you look at Anonymous's, if you look at why they were formed in the first place, it was to go against a certain religious group that they had issues with. So their goal has always been PR, and being a public group just without, being anonymous, a huge anonymous force, just like, the end of V for Vendetta, all of them wearing the masks, So I guess you're right. I know that at some point I think people are going to look at this and say, this is really interesting. It's really cool. I want to be just like these guys. And we start seeing corporations having their dirty laundry aired just for grins and giggles.
Proactive WikiLeaks, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You don't think that there's going to be a bit of a difference there, because Anonymous seem to have a great deal of public backing. Lots of people who essentially are sympathisers for their cause.
Yeah.
So they go after people who aren't really that good in the first place, and because of that, the public almost urge them to push forward and to go on and to do more stuff. Now, don't get me wrong. Anonymous, whatever they do, is wrong. Under the law, they should be brought to account for it. There's absolutely no question. But the people that they go after, they're not exactly the nicest people in the world either. So, that's... I think this is bad for HB Gary, because they're going to be lumped in with these other organisations, you know, like these specific religions, you know, like WikiLeaks, people who have got a very negative public profile at the moment. Does that make any sense?
I think they've been pretty isolated from the religious aspect. I think, you know, because they went after Anonymous specifically over the WikiLeaks issue, I think it's been easier to tie them together. But I've noticed that a lot of the media coverage hasn't really done that. It's been sort of mentioned in passing, and mostly it's just been about what happened to HB Gary and who did it, but not, you know, it's been a lot of the what and the who, but not a lot of the why, you know. So I don't know if I would say that they've been lumped in with those groups specifically over these incidents strictly because of the media attention they've gotten.
Fair enough. On a side note, I don't know if anybody saw of what's happening in the last week or so with the Westboro Baptists.
But which is interesting too, because that is that whole kind of PR thing of, you know, Westboro Baptists allegedly taking the position of masking an anonymous attack on themselves to bring attention to their cause. You know, it's certainly interesting from the, I guess, from the public light of it, you know, to see, you know. And I have to actually say, if you told me 15, probably 10 years ago, there was going to be a hacker group being talked about in this light as much as a kind of socially aware topic, I would have been shocked probably, because, you know, you never, the whole thing with kind of seeing how the hacking community has kind of grown up and things, you wouldn't have thought that it was has now become such an I guess mainstream kind of thing. But it's interesting now that they become a launching point for people now to spin attention their way.
Yeah. It just seems as if our roles as forensic examiners and incident responders has never been quite so at the fore as it has been the last few weeks with HB Gary. And I think that it's going to be interesting how things progress in the field from this point forward, because now, like you said, it's things like this, they could become quite commonplace, and so our games are going to have to be stepped up so that we don't get caught in a trap.
Yeah, well, I think it's certainly I think from a technological aspect, it certainly backs up the old argument that all your infrastructure matters. You know, because when you look at the postmortem of the compromise, you know, it involves a lot of old attacks, but, you know, you just had a bunch of insecure systems that, you know, they compromised one and then jumped from one to a more secure system. But still, you know, when your passwords are the same between systems, you have issues, you know, and I've heard argued for years that, oh, well, that system's not important because it's not a production system, or it's just a test box, or it's just a playground for the engineering staff. And really, it boils down to the fact that every
piece
of your
network?
Infrastructure. Yeah.
If I get the SAM keys and the reg keys and I crack the passwords and then apply them to other areas, is that a problem? Yeah, they don't. They think it's so isolated when they don't realize it. These little data repositories are usually have good memories of and usually reflect what else is on the infrastructure.
Absolutely.
Cool. All right. Well, I think we've. Everyone's talked about the HB Gary Anonymous story for a couple of weeks now, so I think we'll leave it there unless anything else appears anytime soon. But Something else which cropped up in the field this last week or so is that you pronounce it IASIS?
Yes.
Right. See, over here, I don't know. So IASIS have now said they're opening up the CFCE to non-law enforcement. And I think, Doug, you were the first person to mention this over Forensic Focus. So do you want to fill us in a little bit?
Well, I've been kind of following it for a little while because, you know, certainly when you get into the field, it's the what certifications do I get? And it's, you know, you start kind of doing your assessment, and the CFC it's a pretty well-known one for people that are in the industry. You know, I'd certainly a lot of law clients inquire about it, and, you know, it was something that was traditionally a law enforcement only group that IACIS, ISIS, however you want to say, you know, was a law enforcement group, and you had to be current law enforcement, former law enforcement, and they had the CFC that was a certification for the people in their group. And they voted last year to open the certification up, not necessarily the entire organization, but the certification to non-law enforcement. And I'd been just kind of watching it, and then post on Forensic Forecast and started poking around on their website that now the first enrollments are coming up, I believe after this week, from March 1st, you can get into the program and start, you know, applying for the ability to take the exam, where I don't think that from what I understand now that you can't get the training that they offer. I mean, certainly there's other training out there, and they kind of tell you where you should focus your core competencies to learn about it and apply for, you know, those areas to the test. And, you know, there's this two-stage test with a mentoring program, and if you get through both first phase, then you're eligible to take the second phase. And if you pass, you can now become a non-law enforcement CFCE. So the thing is that I always looked at it from was, well, when I spoke to people that said, okay, well, if you're not going to take the CFCE, the CCE is a good public comparable certification program and certified computer examiner program. And it was born out of a lot of the people that were kind of associated with the others. And so now it was always like, okay, well, now which one to go for if there's two kind of similar thought bodies that created two certifications?
I personally would go for the CCE, but that's because I hold it, first of all. Second of all, because Mark McKinnon is on the board for the ISFCE, and I don't want to bring his wrath down upon me by any means. But we've talked quite a lot in this field about law enforcement only things like conferences or talks at conferences, software, that kind of stuff. Now, this is progress, though, isn't it? They're actually coming out and saying, right, we're not just restricting this to law enforcement personnel. We are opening this up to other areas. So we should be backing this, though, shouldn't we?
It's a good thing. It's nice to have another certification available. The CFCE has got a lot of respect for it because it's been around for a while. It's a rigorous certification. I know one of the reasons why the IASIS people were interested in opening it up is if you want to get accredited, at least through the FSAB, which is the acronym. Now the pressure's on, the acronym escapes me, but it's the accreditation board that's affiliated with the American Academy of Forensic Science. If you want to go for that particular accreditation, you need to have your certification open, and that does not require membership. And I'm not sure if that's the same standard for the ANSI certification, because that's the route that GIAC went. So there's a couple different ways that you can get your forensic certifications accredited. One through the FSAB route, the other one through the ANSI route. So I think that's a good thing because I think that helps the community build up credibility that our certifications, you know, certification is basically a third party saying, look, forensic examiner, you have certain basic skills, and we're validating that. And the accreditation is kind of in the same way, or it says, look, you know, certification authority, you know, we're the third party and we're signing off that, you know, you have a program that meets certain standards. So having the CFCE open to everyone, I think that's very helpful. But yeah, you know, if you're choosing between the CFCE and the CCE, I don't know how you do that. They're both good certifications. And I, you know, originally when I was looking at adding a vendor neutral certification, because I started out just with the ENCE, which is actually a very good certification program, because there's it's a tool program, but it's also a general certification program. It includes a practical. So, you know, I had it for a while, but I said, look, I want to add a vendor neutral type thing. Yeah. And I was looking at, you know, okay, do I want to do GIAC? Do I want to do, because I'm an associate member of IASIS, you know, I could have done the CFCE under the closed program. Do I want to do CCE? And then things just worked out where the money came through to attend the GIAC training. So I did the GCFA, and, you know, so I won't do the CFCE or the CCE. Not because they're not good certifications, they are. It's just, okay, I've got my vendor neutral one, and, you know, if an employer wants me to add more, you know, I can certainly go through the program, but at this point, I've got more certifications than I know what to do with. So yeah, it's good, you know. And I don't. It's a very good program. They spend a lot of time on the testing process. It's very thorough. I can speak just as a hiring manager. If somebody shows up for a job and they've got a CFCE, that looks great. In fact, one of the last people I've hired actually had that. So it's the more the merrier.
Cool. Thought somebody else would jump in then. Sorry.
I killed the conversation. Super.
I think he covered it, really.
Yeah, I think there's always that going to be that discussion, isn't there, of, you know, how do you know that the certifications are good enough or a fair representation of the knowledge and the skill of that person? All you have to do is look at some of the things on the mailing lists for the certifications where people asking questions that really they should know the answer to if they've done the certificate, if they've done the examination for the certification and whatnot.
Yeah.
And this is why I'm a big, big fan of the whole CDFS movement. And I really think that finding the holy grail of certifications is really what we should be heading towards and supporting, so that we all can look at each other and say, right, yep, that person is properly qualified. It's almost, you know, it's like the forensics version of PI licensing. That's for you, Luby. We need something.
I absolutely agree with you, Lee, because there are a lot of disparate certifications, as was previously mentioned. A lot of the only ones originally open to, you know, private sector investigators and analysts were the vendor certs. You know, you've got your access data cert, your guidance NK cert. You know, and a lot of some of these certs were not open to us. But now, you know, as they become available, we end up having a glut of certs on the market. I too would like to see maybe preferably one really holy grail cert that would be a good indicator that it all. But if you look at all the certification arguments, no matter what the field is, you always come down with you have people who take tests really well. And then you have people who are really good at what they do, and sometimes those two groups there may not be a lot of convergence. So how do you realistically measure ability in those circumstances? Do you make them take a test and then make them take a test again 2 years later that incorporates all the latest additions to the field? You know, is that onerous on the you know, certification holder? Is it a lot of work for the certifying body? You know, so I don't know. I know that in the U.S. that you mentioned PI licensing, and I'm not a big fan of it personally because we have it here in Texas. And unfortunately, last I checked, the PI licensing program and the licensing requirements don't really cover anything to do with digital forensics investigations at all.
No, we find. Yeah, I just had to do an acquisition in Texas, and you know, we called up and said, okay, well, you know, what do we have to submit? And the PI that I had it on the job, you know, we have X number of days, and we kind of looked over everything that was that we had to swap their paperwork and explain to them, and we really couldn't see, okay, well, why? You know, what is this? What about the statute of the PI law that really applies to what we're doing have anything to do with it? It was very. It didn't make a lot of sense. So.
And that's one of the things that I know CDFS is going to be dealing with. I'm actually pretty strongly opposed to the idea of the one search to rule them all, because I'm opposed to – not only opposed to private investigations licensing, and I think I may be an intellectual minority on this. I've blogged on it before, but I'm opposed to licensing, period, for digital forensics people. I think it creates a cartel system. I don't see that it does. It's necessary. Courts are perfectly capable of figuring out, you know, who experts are and regulating that sort of thing. And I don't like the idea of, you know, one primary cert that the industry standardizes on, because that gives whatever organization behind that too much power and also essentially backdoors us into a guild system. So that's one of the reasons I like, you know, for example, seeing that the CFCE is coming online for more people. I like the competition. I would like to have, I don't necessarily want thousands of certs, but, you know, I like having the idea of, you know, a bunch of different organizations, you know, reputable organizations behind different certs to add some diversity to it and to keep things decentralized. Now the second question, is that realistic? We'll see. I got a feeling that basically, digital forensics community, that's going to be overtaken by events, and we may end up with, you know, a couple certifications that tend to run the whole thing, depending on how licensing works. So we'll see, but I'm still trying to stand athwart history, and you'll stop on this.
Well, in a perfect world, I agree with you. I think, unfortunately, at least as we found out in Texas 4 years ago, the genie's out of the bottle on the licensing requirement. And, you know, realistically, there's no way it's ever going to go back, because the law wasn't changed. It was strictly an interpretation of the law by the Private Securities Board, which is the group that handles the PI licensing in Texas.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, and my point to try and be as brief as possible is that without somebody at the national or even the international level coming in and saying this is what you need to be qualified is the only way you're going to stop all these, you know, state legislatures or private security boards from saying, well, that's now ours, because you know, we have a forensics board in the state of Texas. I don't understand why it's not part of that, unless you want to get into the argument that digital forensics isn't really a forensic science, which, you know, That's a whole other case.
That's a whole different. Yeah,
I'm a big fan of that argument. That's just because I've been filling out ISO requirements for a forensics lab for the last 3 months. So, I'd like to take this opportunity to announce the forensic forecast certification.
Is it a $3,000 training program that we had to sign up for?
Wow, how did you
Absolutely.
Know? It just makes the check payable to Lee Whitfield. All right. Cool. Well, we're kind of running a little low on time, but I promised Eric for like months now that we would have a conversation about the future of forensic software, and I think it all started with the release of FTK Imager version 3, didn't it?
Yeah, I think it was FTK 3. Even some of the stuff that Access Data was doing kind of had me thinking about this, and Doug deals with this space too, because I know since he does the disco work, he's got a lot of tool issues. But yeah, I blogged on this a while ago. It's just kind of interesting to watch how our tools have changed, because before I even started back in the day, it was, you know, they had tools that weren't set up to specifically be used for digital forensics, things like hex editors. And there was an organization still out there called NTI out in, I think it's Oregon, that had some very good DOS tools. And, you know, there was a lot of, you know, DOS-based tools that were out there that started to be specifically designed for forensics, and then you saw, you know, the expert witness, which turned into Encase, and you kind of had that era where you had specifically designed software that was basically glorified hex editors, and probably not the best way to say it, I'll call it enhanced hex editors, where they had that function of making a disk image, parsing a file system, and doing a lot of nice additional stuff. You know, Guidance does it through their end scripts. And then FTK, you know, same functionality. They had DT search, which they plugged in there. And these are fairly some, and this is still, you know, these type of tools are still used today. These are fairly powerful tools that, you know, a digital forensic examiner can run in a small lab, and they can do the care and feeding of it. But as FTK 3 rolled out, now you've got, you know, a more complicated database structure, which you can still do the care and feeding of, but now you're talking about an Oracle database. And I can just see where this is going, because as these tools, because our data sets are going to be so much larger, and because of the functionality that the digital forensic companies are now building into these tools, they can do some fairly amazing things. I think we're seeing a day where, you know, is if you're a manager and you're running a lab, you have to make some decisions as far as, you know, as the tools become more complex, you have to start bringing people in. And this is very on the discovery front. I see this more and more. You have to start bringing people in whose only jobs are for the care and the feeding of the tools, which, you know, for a small police department, that's not an option. But for these larger labs, you know, then you're going to have to start making decisions of, okay, do I start bringing people in, like, you know, database administrators, developers, that sort of thing, for, you know, the care and the feeding of the tools? Or do you move to a software as a service model where the vendors do that for you? You interact with your tools, let's say, you know, through either a web-based portal or, you know, some other way where, you know, maybe some of it's inside your environment, maybe some of it's, you know, someplace else. So I think we're heading in that direction, at least for some stuff. I'm not predicting the demise of, you know, Encase Forensic or, you know, FTK3, because I think you'll still have smaller digital forensic labs who still do, you know, the more the tactical stuff, you know, smaller stale cases. You'll be able to do that inside your environment. You won't necessarily have to hire, you know, a database administrator to do your work. But for the larger scale stuff, the tools are becoming more complex, and I think there's going to be some different business models and some different options down the road that will be enabled by, you know, cloud computing. And all cloud computing is okay, you've got a really good bandwidth to, you know, server space, which is, you know, easily expandable. I mean, it's a kind of a crude way of saying it, but there's nothing particularly magical about that. But it does open up some possibilities that I think we'll start seeing in the digital forensics and media discovery space.
Yeah.
Well, it's also, you know, I try to break it down in a very linear fashion sometimes when I say, okay, well, where what tools are going to apply to what area depending on what I'm doing at a given time? You know, where if you're looking at the collection, the preservation, to preservation, to then maybe going into analysis, or then preservation now to extraction. There's different sets of tools, even within the same vendors, that work in various degrees of accuracy and how well you know them. And I still think, you know, really when we're in that early set, you know, whether it is for analysis for investigation or analysis for discovery, or you're doing discovery production, it's very important to know those early phases, how the tools are working. And my fear is that there's this been this kind of homogenizing of it. We're saying, well, yeah, that doesn't matter. You know, we're seeing things from, like, even from Legal Tech a couple weeks ago in New York, where people are like, oh, yeah, that's great that we're incorporating some of these forensic tools into the, you know, the e-discovery stuff. And, you know, my folks are always saying, well, that's great. But that entry point of when you pull the data out and put it into another system, if you're not knowing how well that stuff's working, can be a problem. So it shouldn't be glossed over. And my fear is that, you know, that might be what's happening, is saying, well, that's not an important part. You know, we don't really try to commoditize the collection part as much as we really want to charge per gigabyte for processing and analysis. And, you know, that's really all that matters. But really, you know, when I get back to it, I still find errors in other people's production when they're using the basic tools, and you ask them about it and they're saying, yeah, I don't know. I use it all the time. I press the button and it does what it is advertised to do. And they don't really have the granularity to understand how the data works and is composed. And that's my fear, is that if it becomes, I wouldn't say too simple, but too, we lose focus of how the early set, and, you know, pulling of the data out with the tools works, that creates problems down the line.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a favorite conversation topic of Mark McKinnon and I about basically button jockey forensics, where, you know, you have somebody with a case open and they have a set of end scripts which they run, and that's it. They don't understand what the end scripts do. They don't understand all the principles behind what Encase itself is doing, and you lose something. It's very, very, yeah. I mean, there's one or two ways which you'll go. Is that people will separate in the field, in my opinion, with the development of new tools. Lever get to the point where you've got people who plug in like the Paraben porn stick or something and just find all the images that way. And then you'll have the people who really know what they're doing, who can go in and manually do the work. And I just think there's going to be quite a bit of diversity in the future in regards to this.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I sit on an advisory board for a local college with the digital forensics program. And that's one of the things we stress, is that you can't be a button pushing forensics, you know, forensic analyst. I'm sorry, I can't talk. but your analysis can't just be, I ran this end script, because you really have to know what it's doing. And that's actually, you know, I like end scripts from a shortcut perspective, you know, but I like to know what they do. And that's why I get really frustrated when someone releases an end script in a packed format where I can't look at it and say, okay, I see what it's doing here.
Yeah.
You know, because I have spent years of my life as a programmer. And so I like to look at programs occasionally. And that's not something I'd like to do full time, but when I'm running something and relying on it for my day-to-day, you know, business and something that, you know, that I earn my living with, I like to have a pretty intimate understanding of how it works. And with NScripts or any other scripting language where the source is obfuscated, you know, you sort of lose that. And when, you know, like I've done guidance training, and the first thing they do is they teach you the hard way. And then they say, and now here's an NScript that does all of that stuff. You just push the button, you know, blue check this. And then the analysts, when they leave, they use the end script and they forget the hard way. And so they lose a lot of the why as to why they, you know, why they perform the function in the first place. And that's not a slight on guidance at all, because it's nice to have those tools, you know, to give you the shortcuts in the work, because when you have multiple cases and you have deadlines, it, you know, everyone would love to be able to run an end script as opposed to having to carve files out manually or look for, you know, registry entries manually. Everyone wants those tools that make our lives easier. Going back to the software as a service argument, I think the only thing that really hinders the software as a service, growing in the forensics market is really going to be about bandwidth. You know, the cloud is great if you have an infinite amount of bandwidth. Unfortunately, that's, you know, being in a big city, that works very well for us. And I know a lot of us, we work in those types of situations, but there are many who work in regional labs, some of them out, not necessarily in urban areas. You know, so those kind of people are going to continuously be working with standalone tools. And I think a lot of effort has been put into making the tools easier to use, and that's what makes trying not to have an army of button pushing analysts such a hard job, is that the tools become easier, they become more accessible to people, and the end scripts and other activity, you know, or other little tools make their jobs easier. And so it's very hard to make sure that those people are really competent at what they're doing instead of just being button pushers.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely have that. There's the Moore's Law effect of what the data we're dealing with, and also the perception of what it is too. You know, I can't think of how many cases start with is, hey, I got one computer for you to look at, and then six devices later, you know, it always seems.
Oh, I hate that.
It's every single, you know, you think it's one, and it's, oh yeah, there was that USB hard drive in the phone, and this, oh yeah, the server. Oh, I forgot to tell you about the server.
And there were like, six hard drives in the computer instead of just the one.
Yes.
And by that point, you're dealing with terabytes of data as opposed to what you originally expected, and it becomes really a difficult thing to manage.
And you just got to get through it, too, because then you set your expectations on, well, yeah, you know, it should take X number of days and we're looking at this. And then when the scope changes, you try to advise a client on where the obviously the changes are going to be, but you're still working within the timeline. You really have to learn how to focus on the most effective areas. And I, even on one hard drive, you can spend forever just looking at everything. But, you know, what's the most effective areas and what's really going to hit home on the case? And actually, I think when, you know, a lot of what Ovi Carroll had said and when he was at the New York ForSec meeting in September of the last year, was like, he's like, you know, a lot of what we do is, you know, with some of the triage things is we hit it at 90% success rate because we can find the most pertinent information very quickly with something like Drive Profit, throw it in front of the person, get the confession and move on. So, you know, sometimes I try to think of that mode too, even working on the litigation. Okay, what's the most effective point of what they're looking for so I can get it to them and see if that's enough. And if we need more, we can go back. But it's, you know, we have to, I think, also change our thinking about how we're going through the data and our approach to be very, very efficient because the data sets are growing, the devices are getting more complicated, and, you know, time is short.
Yeah.
You know, I just wonder if we're the authors of our own demise here, because as we create more and more advanced forensics tools, things which are easier for us to use, easier for other people who are unskilled to use, you know, we're going to get into that situation, aren't we, where basically we reduce forensic investigations down to a single button press. Eventually, we're going to come down to the find evidence button. At that point, don't we all become, you know, pretty much obsolete?
Well, the fear in that is that, you know, it's how much do you trust the tool? And you have to always go back to kind of what the, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Explain it the hard way. And that's the thing where, you know, yeah, I'll run net analysis on a lot of things, but then I'll still do maybe in cases, you know, internet history browsers or things like that, where you just want to, I just have this natural compulsion to want to say, okay, I don't trust what I'm seeing. So I got to go look at it and see other things just to make sure, because I'd hate to put my neck out on the line, sign the report, and then have something come back on me. And I've seen it happen with other examiners where they say, yes, this is 100%. This happened. And then I said, but did you actually look at this? And then, oh no. Well, no, we didn't. And then the whole story comes apart and yes. It's like, you trusted, yeah. You just put all your faith in your reputation line of one view and end case. And now it's going to carry with you for the rest of your career. That's scary, you know?
Yeah. And now Doug killed the conversation.
Awesome.
Wow.
No, I agree
with
Doug.
Don't trust your tools. Don't trust anybody. Everybody's out to get you. Join Anonymous. There you go.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
Yeah.
No, speaking of catastrophic thinking, yeah, the porn stick isn't going to put us out of business. Yeah, it's you know, what we do is too complex to rely on the find evidence button.
Right. Now, I do see the sort of, you know, in the field triage products. That seems to be where a lot of the focus has been over the last at least 18 months.
Yeah.
From all the big vendors, I would say that there's probably going to be at least another year or two in, you know, focusing in that space. It honestly seems like everyone's gotten away from their enterprise solutions. I think F-Response has been a big cause for that, because it allows you to use your existing tools just in a more distributed manner.
Yeah.
So I don't see a lot. I don't really know how much farther the enterprise level products can go. I mean, what right now Guidance is selling their enterprise product for $10,000, you know,
yeah, three examiners, and you can be up and running in an enterprise environment, you know, for $10,000. And I think FTK has something similar.
Yeah. And that's a huge, huge, deep discount from their previous pricing models just a year ago, you know,
ever so slightly.
Yeah.
A few zeros. Yeah.
So, well, thank God for F-Response. Yeah, they've really pushed the. I think not just them, but they've really pushed the market down. And that's, you know, speaking of future of digital forensic tools, we have more people playing in the space now, so there's more competition. So prices are going down, at least for some tools. So, you know, hopefully we can get away from the point where we're spending $5,000 for a license of, you know, for these basic tools.
Well, even some of the specialized tools and. Yeah, you have something like FTK Imager that now is, I mean, between
free. Yeah, that's great. It does so much stuff.
And there's viewing. I mean, it's great.
Oh yeah, you can mount stuff, and yeah, no, internet evidence finders. Yeah,
I'm thinking just a year ago when I had a acquired disk image and run it into a VM. The tricks I had to go in or look at costs of products in between Mount Image Pro and something else. Now it's just like between FTK Imager and LiveView. My life has become a lot cheaper and easier.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are tons of great freeware tools out there, because as long as you can defend your methods, the tools you use tend to become irrelevant,
That's it. It's the examiner at the end of the day who should be doing all the validation of the software tools and the scripts and everything else, and should know what to look out for if things are a little bit askew. Okay, this is no doubt a topic we'll come back to on numerous occasions, but in the interest of trying to keep these relatively short, I think we'll stop there for now. Just want to let everybody know, because I've said it on Twitter, on Facebook, on the Forensic Forecast website, that the Forensic Forecast award nominations are now open for 2011. A little bit different to the way they have been in the past, where you have to go on, enter some information about yourself, and then give a reason as to why you're nominating that person or organization or tool or whatever it is that you're nominating, why you think they're deserving of being nominated. So, go to forensicforecast.com. And you'll see just on the right-hand side that thing for nominations, or you can go to the Forensic Forecast Awards bit across the top. Who should people nominate, Eric?
Forensic Forecast. We have to win an award. We've got to win our own award.
I know, we suck.
I know. If you can't rig your own awards, Lee, come on, man.
It's embarrassing.
It shows the transparency and honesty as Lee is an examiner by setting up a whole program to give awards away to other people in a field he actively works in. It's amazing.
There's also that in the bung, which I got from inside the call last year. So,
The award, they stopped podcasting for like 6 months. So
All that was just like just some. It was just a spoiler. We cooked Lee. We don't have to do any more podcasts.
We've reached the pinnacle. We'll now stop.
What are some of the categories? Maybe people should know what are the categories, Lee.
Categories. They pretty much the same as they have been the last few years. Just let me dive onto.
Do they have one for best forensic blog?
We do.
Oh God. No, I'm sorry. I was just asking.
Yeah. let me just go down the list here. Oh, this Mac is rubbish. Outstanding contribution to digital forensics as an individual, outstanding contribution to digital forensics as a company, best digital forensic blog, best digital forensic article or blog posting, best digital forensic book, best digital forensic podcast, best computer forensic hardware tool, best computer forensic software tool, best computer forensic, best phone forensic hardware and software tools, Digital Forensic Examiner of the Year, and then on recommendation of Rob Lee, we've added a couple more this year: Best Law Enforcement / Military / Government Forensics Team, and then Best Civilian Forensics Team as well. So, just bear in mind whenever you're nominating people or things that this is for work conducted in the last 12 months.
Well, that's my question. Now, did Harlan Carvey get his book in time for the nomination for the new registry analysis one?
That would come under this. But if people go in and nominate Windows Forensic Analysis 2nd Edition again this year, then I might take issue with it, because that's 2 years in a row he's actually done that. And I let it slide last year. This year, I'm not so keen on doing that. So it's all about progression, people. Progression.
And so, vendors, there's no excuse. We've posted this on every email digital forensic listserv We've done it on Forensic Forecast, both the forum, which is not affiliated with us, and, of course, here, the podcast. So I don't want to hear any stories about vendors complaining to Lee because your crappy product didn't get a nomination because you didn't realize it was going on.
Or non-crappy product.
Or your non-crappy product.
I sent out emails to all the major players again this year.
Oh, did you? Did you send it out to some of the major vendors?
Yeah.
Okay, that saves us some grief.
Yeah, so hopefully now, if anyone comes back to me, I can just say, oh, by the way, the person didn't pass the message on to you, so bad luck.
I mean, it's amazing what started as a goof is now shaking the industry to people get heated if they're not notified. Multi-million dollar venture capitalist funds that funded companies are like, excuse me.
Really?
Seriously, though, I just sit here thinking, I'm just a guy with the microphone. What on earth's going on?
Well, because you're an authority, because you're a guy with a microphone. There you go.
So, yeah. That's just... so it's open for nominations now. Nominations will be open for quite a while. Probably a few months. The voting won't be open for as long as the nominations, but it'll be open for a little while. We've not quite established a venue or a time for the actual awards ceremonies to go ahead yet, but we'll... We'll sort that out, and we'll come back to you and let everyone know. So, yeah, that's pretty much it. Just last thing to do then is just basically wrap up. So, just like to say thank you once again to Eric Huber. He's pretty much becoming a permanent fixture at Forensic Forecast these days. So, thanks again, Eric. We don't endure you. Don't be ridiculous. It's a pleasure to have you on. You're the voice of reason in what would otherwise be very, very chaotic. And that's evidenced by the way that me and Simon actually did the podcast before you came along. So
correct. Yes.
And you can find Eric at ericjhuber.com for his Fistful of Dongles blog. And you can also follow him on Twitter. And it's don't even know what it is. What is it again?
It's AFOD blog. So
AFOD blog on Twitter. And then also thank you once again to Doug being on. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. And I just want to just get a quick plug in for the our local meetup group that Eric is a part of as well as New York. NYC 4SEC, New York 4SEC group. They're just a local group of information security professionals, law enforcement, non-law enforcement, educational, just trying to get the community, local community together to meet more often, away from Twitter and more in face-to-face. We've had some really good speakers. We've had Ovi Carroll, Lenny Zeltzer. We've had some really good presentations. We try to do it about once a month. Check us out at NYC4SEC.info for more information.
Awesome stuff. And also, we thank you, Joseph, as well, who's been on for his first time, and judging by this performance, won't be his last time either.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
It's been a pleasure having you on. So, yeah, all that's left to say is thank you very much, and we'll catch you next time. Bye for now. Just one more thing before I let you back to your busy lives. Running a podcast obviously incurs costs and fees and everything else. And the equipment which we're using for recording Forecast at the moment isn't that reliable, which is why we didn't produce anything in January. Basically we're looking for a little bit of investment. So if you'd like to go to the Forensic Forecast webpage, look at the donate thing across the top of the webpage, click on it, and whatever you can give, whether it's, $5, $10, equivalent in pounds, whatever it is, would be great to have. And also, Forensic Forecast is potentially looking for sponsors. So if you'd like to sponsor the podcast or the blog, please let me know. Bye for now.